Making Rainbow Waves. Making Rainbow Waves is a podcast by ILGA World in which we tell the stories of LGBTI human rights defenders worldwide. And this one is a special episode for us because we are celebrating the 10th anniversary of our UN program. Our guest today is actually the program manager of our UN program, Ksenia Kilichenko. Welcome, Ksenia.
Thank you, Daniele. It's a really nice experience to be here.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. And as I said, today we're celebrating the 10th anniversary of our UN program. And so actually my first question for you is really if you could tell us the story of how the program was created and how it developed during the years.
Yes, sure. And well, I myself was with ILGA World, working for ILGA World since 2016. But I also know the story behind at least some part of it, and I'm happy to share it with you. And well, speaking about the history of ILGA and the UN program at ILGA, we also need to think about the history of civil society or NGOs at the UN. Because initially, of course, the UN was created as a state-centered mechanism, institution, machine. But then with the time, more and more mechanisms for civil society to engage were created. Initially, or I would say, let's say in late 80s, 90s, the participation of civil society within the UN spaces was related to ECOSOC status. And well, when ILGA initially didn't have this status, we still already started to engage with the UN. And as a UN nerd, I did some research some time ago, and I found really old documents that already mention ILGA, or people who were speaking on behalf of ILGA. And one of the first such experience was in 1992. We haven't had yet at that point the ECOSOC status, but Douglas Sanders, who were unfortunately passed away a year ago, but he participated there already through Human Rights Advocates, the organization that had ECOSOC status at this point. And he made a speech at the Commission on Human Rights, now Human Rights Council, but at that point it was called Commission on Human Rights. And in 1992, he was telling that there is ILGA at that time with only 500 members. And he also said that, you know, gay and lesbian people, they live in all the countries in the world. They are a part of the population, but at the same time, we are not represented at the UN. So he requested basically the representation of gay and lesbian people at the UN. And also mentioned that by that point, ILGA already had engagement with the WHO, the World Health Organization, and also contributed to the Fernand Laurent study on sexual minorities. So it was also a very interesting document, historical document that ILGA contributed to. And if people are interested in history of LGBTI rights, I think it's a really like a gem for all the nerds like me. So this study was from late 80s, and it was perhaps the first official UN document and a report on the topic. And while it's sometimes funny, because it's still 1980s, and it says things such as, for example, lesbians are the counterparts of homosexuals in the female world, and they usually meet their partners in the homes of friends. So it's like a little bit weird and funny, but still, already in this report, there were chapters on lesbians and chapters on trans people. And ILGA was able, already there in 1980s, was able to contribute to this report. So that was one of the first appearances of ILGA in 1992. And then a year after, already on behalf of ILGA, because at that point we had ECOSOC status, also Douglas Sanders again participated and shared that our representatives, about a dozen open lesbians and gay men from Australia, Austria, Brazil, Canada, Ecuador, Germany, Mexico, Peru, and the United States. So different countries, not just the Global North, participated in the World Conference on Human Rights. So 1990s were, it was a decade of world conferences on human rights. The Vienna Conference, the Beijing Conference, focusing on women's rights, and we were there already. So that was also a little bit of history. And well, so that's how things were initially developed. We didn't have, for a long time, we didn't have a dedicated UN program. But this changed in 2013, 10 years ago, with Ilga Wolt first hiring the UN Advocacy and Program Manager, André Duplessis, who is now without, right? But yes, André was the first specific UN employee at Ilga Wolt. And then also at that time, Ilga Wolt moved from Brussels to Geneva. And one of the reasons was also to, you know, to leave the European institutions to Ilga Europe, and also for us, Ilga Wolt, to work closely with the United Nations, which is based in Geneva. So that was one of the reasons also why the office moved. And then soon after that, also one and then another one person, they were hired to do work on UPR, Human Rights Council, and treaty bodies. And then in 2016, I joined Ilga as initially as an officer working on treaty bodies and special procedures. So that's where my history with Ilga Wolt started as an employee, because I was working for, you know, member organizations before. But yeah, so that's already a part with my presence. And well, now I'm the UN program manager. I'm leading the program. And well, when I joined, we only had three people working for the UN program. André, who was the manager, and then Diana, who was doing work on UPR and Human Rights Council, and I was doing treaty bodies and special procedures. Today, we are four people who are working full-time for Ilga. So it's me, myself, who is managing the program, and I'm doing treaty bodies work. We also have Gabriel leading our UPR and Human Rights Council engagement. Also, Guillermo, who is doing special procedures work and SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals. So it's also the addition to our portfolio. And then last but not least, we started to do more systemic work on implementation of UN recommendations. And we have Gitao, who is leading our national advocacy engagement, plus also two junior professional consultants, and one consultant specifically on treaty bodies. So yeah, we grow quite a lot during this decade and even before, and I'm happy to be part of this process.
Thank you so much. And it's really fascinating to go through all the story of our engagement with the United Nations. And I know actually that there are also other parts outside of human rights specific bodies. For example, I know from our history, the then co-secretary general, Lisa Power, in 1991, for example, raised homosexuality, and she was the first out person to do that as the United Nations in New York, as part of the ILGA delegation that went to the ECOSOC NGO committee, and that was about ILGA's membership application. So there are literally bits and pieces of ILGA's history all around the history also of the United Nations in the past 30 years. And it's really fascinating, because my next question actually was, from your unique vantage point, how do you describe how the United Nations have helped advance the recognitions of the human rights of LGBTI people throughout all these years?
Yeah, it's a good question. And of course, because the idea of international human rights law, at least from this like positivistic view, it connected directly to the United Nations. So we have core human rights instruments that protect human rights adopted at the UN, at the United Nations, and therefore, of course, the UN has contributed enormously to the development of the discourse of human rights. And the idea and the establishment of LGBTI rights, or SOGIESC human rights, this was also happening at the United Nations. And well, the beautiful part of it is that because it's a universal system, the global system, the standards, when they are formed, they are not formed just in one country, but they're spreading throughout the world. And the perfect example is the decision on Tunin case. So Tunin versus Australia, it's a groundbreaking case from 1994, when the Human Rights Committee for the first time recognized that criminalization of consensual same-sex sexual acts between, well, men for Australia, it's a violation of the international human rights, specifically the right to privacy. But this decision that was made against Australia, this decision influenced a lot of legal jurisprudential developments throughout the world. And just to mention that this decision was cited by regional and national courts, by the European Court of Human Rights, by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, and also by different courts from India and Nepal to the Philippines and Fiji to Colombia to South Africa and Zimbabwe. So it's a really very strong standard that was developed in 1994 at the UN, by the UN, and then traveled really globally. And today, well, today we see that despite the fact that LGBTI people, LGBTI human rights, SOGIESC, they are not explicitly mentioned in the human rights conventions, the treaty bodies and other bodies of the UN that interpret, that implement these conventions, they made LGBTI human rights language their own language. For instance, the Human Rights Committee, which is monitoring the implementation of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, today they literally do LGBTI recommendations on every country under review. So every country is asked about LGBTI rights, and this is the part of the human rights language today, now for sure. Or we can also think about special procedures. Special procedures, these are groups of independent experts or individual independent experts appointed by the UN Human Rights Council. And they are more flexible because they are not really bound by the convention's texts. But they were really those who developed the language, speaking for the first time about corrective rapes, for instance, or let's say one of the latest reports by the Special Rapporteur on Health, when she introduced and explained what is the inclusive non-binary approach to gender-based violence. So really, we've seen how the language was formed, how it is developing, how it is adapting to new concepts and the living realities of our communities. But also, I think that it's not just the UN. So it's not just the UN that decided one day that we want to protect LGBTI persons' human rights, of course. So I would dare to say that behind all these victories, there are real people, LGBTI activists, movements, and the Tunin decision, if we talk about this decision, it was brought by an activist from Australia, and a lot of other victories or developments, they also were supported by activists.
Thank you for all this very thorough explanation. And I think this is important not just for you and other self-proclaimed nerds, as you have described yourself during this conversation, but as you said, all of this, even if it sounds remote and abstract to many, it has real-life implications on people and on our communities. So it's really important to make it known. And as you said, over the years, ILGA World's UN program has supported hundreds of human rights defenders and grassroots activists to engage within UN spaces. So can you describe a little bit the work that we as an organization do with them?
Yes, sure. Thank you, Daniela. And I think that our basis of our approach as a membership organization is to share our privilege and to provide this space, to give this space to activists. So I think that this is the basis. And our mission, if you want, is to really to support those working on the ground. So we are not just developing, sitting in Geneva, strategies and then, you know, just imposing them on activists in different parts of the world. But we are at least trying as much as possible to ground all our efforts in the needs and realities of the movement. And what we are specifically doing with this principle, we provide training on technicalities on how to engage with the UN. Because ultimately, of course, it's activists who are experts on their own situations, country situations, and they know what is happening, they know what is the problems. But sometimes the UN can sound like really this huge monster that only available to governments or international human rights lawyers with, I don't know, Oxford diplomas or whatever, which is sometimes true, but also civil society now, today, after all the years, have much more spaces to engage with the UN. And our task is to explain how to use this system, because sometimes it can really be, well, not super easy, but it's not a rocket science. So what we do, we provide training, we help activists to put their demands, their needs into the UN language. We also help them sometimes when needed to write reports to the UN, because there are also, you know, some tips and tricks how to present the situation, how to formulate recommendations, what examples, what illustrations to use to prove the point, and so on and so forth. Then also we are helping activists to come to Geneva or to New York and to engage with these spaces, because one thing is, of course, to write a report or to submit a communication to the UN, but it's also important to give the advocacy a human face. And also to talk to UN representatives, because after all, they're also humans, and it's important to have the opportunity to talk to them, to explain to them what is important, why it's important. And we've seen a lot of very interesting examples of such advocacy. So we're also bringing activists to UN spaces, and we help them to engage with the friendly UN representatives, such as committee members or officers of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights or special procedures and so on and so forth. And then also we help with the implementation of UN recommendations when needed. So we also have some best practices, good practices related to the implementation of the recommendations. And in doing so, we are also trying at least to use intersectional approach and to give the space to people who may be usually not that present within the movement as well. For instance, we had projects in the past when we worked with LGBTI persons and groups with disabilities, and we engaged with the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, with the Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. We also prepared quite a lot of submissions on the intersection of race and SOGIES. So we are also trying to work from this perspective, and also to support trans groups, to support intersex groups, to support LGBTQI women's groups. So that's how we do it. And also to make sure that we are not only focusing on the so-called Global North, but we support as well, and maybe first of all, groups from other parts of the world.
Thank you. Thanks for that. And yeah, I have to say that I've been watching all your work on the side, documenting your work on the side for all these years also. And one of the best part of our work, I think, is also to get to know all these activists who do such an amazing work on the ground, and to support them in the way we can. And there is one thing that one of these activists said one time has really stayed with me over the years. And she said, the United Nations need us more than what we need the UN, because without civil society, the United Nations doesn't really know where to look when it's time to address the practical matters, right? So I was wondering whether you have a memory or an engagement with an activist or a moment in all these years of works that has particularly stayed with you.
Yes. I have so many memories, of course, and so many examples of really beautiful projects, advocacy campaigns, passionate fighting for LGBTI human rights. So it's really difficult to pick one moment, but maybe I would share this story, her story. And it's maybe not very traditional for the UN, but still. So it was a few years ago. We were at Palais des Nations, the main building of the UN here in Geneva. And there was an activist from Angola, a feminist queer activist. And it was something like, you know, quite traditional, like a panel, and people were speaking in microphones, and there was an interpretation, and there were diplomats in costumes. And then after the meeting, we just stayed together, the civil society group, and I was talking to her, and we were just like chatting about how to organize this advocacy, how to make it more meaningful for LGBTI communities. And then she took a book from her bag and showed to me this book, and it was Bell Hooks, All About Love. And she told me, well, this is I think how we need to do our advocacy. And yeah, so that was so beautiful moment. And this connection between our, you know, foremothers, all the people who stand behind us, and all the people who developed these ideas, who were fighting for intersectional justice. So yeah, that's how bell hooks became about the UN for me. And really, like she said, for example, that awakening to love can only happen as we let go of our obsession with power and domination. And I think this is exactly about what we are doing, because for me, this domination and formal power, it's already there. And the UN is also, to some extent, it's about there. But when we do our advocacy, I think that we need to think about also love as a healing force and love as a longing for communion, and to do it together as a movement and to share this love and to show this love in a broad sense to the United Nations, and also to change even the meaning of the power, the formal power, and to bring our understanding into these spaces. Well, that's the story.
Thank you. That's really beautiful. And yeah, speaking about community, I think one of the greatest achievements of civil society worldwide at the UN within Sojiesk issue has been really, you know, civil society coming together and advocating for a mandate that specifically addresses violence and discriminations on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. The mandate was first created in 2016, but of course that's the result of years-long battle and commitment. And now we're 7 years in the existence of the mandate. So how would you describe the impact of the mandate having been so far? And how do you see Hilga World's support in the mandate continue going forward?
Yeah, and here I have another story. Just to say that even the establishment of the mandate is already a very important point. So I was engaged with LGBTI human rights long before I joined ILGA, and in the beginning of 2013 or 14, there was a convening here in Geneva with activists, LGBTI activists working in different countries. And we were here talking about how we would love to see the UN, the world, how we can use the human rights. And then someone said that, well, ideally, we would have a convention on the elimination of all forms of discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. And then we were all laughing because it sounds like a really very utopic dream. And then someone says, well, let's be a little bit more modest and maybe we can have a special rapporteur on Sochi. And then everyone was also laughing, saying that, well, maybe not in this era, maybe not in this century. But then just 2-3 years after that, the mandate was actually established in 2016. For the first time on the global level at the UN, we managed, together with efforts by, yes, friendly governments and sister movements, other movements, we managed together as a collective effort to establish this mandate. And then during 7 years of the existence of this mandate, we've seen a lot of important achievements made by this mandate, through this mandate, and thanks to this mandate. And it can go from, you know, just establishing connections with difficult subjects, because, for instance, Victor Madrigal, the previous already mandate holder, he was speaking to different groups, to religious groups in countries that he was visiting. And he was speaking to difficult governments, to subjects that sometimes are not really accessible to LGBTI movements or activists. But he was able, through his position, through sharing his power, sharing his privilege, so he was able to establish connections and to talk, at least to open the dialogue. We also have seen, you know, bills that were postponed or not adopted with the engagement of the independent expert on Sochi, who was explaining that these bills are against human rights. And then it goes to really very simple stories of sometimes lives saved through communications, but not only. But I know of the stories when people are still with us just because the independent experts intervened at the right point. And this is a huge support for all of us. This is about also mainstreaming the Sochi language, mainstreaming LGBTI human rights. Also, I would say that throughout these 7 years of the mandate, a lot of very important critical conversations have been opened. For example, on intersectionality. What does it mean, intersectionality for LGBTI human rights? For example, colonialism, which is a very important topic for our movement and for LGBTI human rights. And this is one of the latest final reports of Victor Madrigal. So I hope that with the new mandate, with the new years of the mandate, we'll be able to, together with the movement, with activists, we will be able to develop further these important concepts, these important ideas of intersectionality, of the colonial approach, and to also show how it should look like in practice, how it should look like for the lives of real people on the ground. Yeah, so I think that that was very important. And of course, we will continue working with the new mandate and also building bridges when needed between grassroots activists and the UN system and this mandate.
Thank you very much. And we're almost at the end of our conversation today, but maybe one last question would be, with all that's happening in the world these days, I think that trust in the effectiveness of international human rights law seems to be at a very minimum these days. So how do you think that global human rights spaces like the United Nations can restore people's faith in the power of international human rights law and the mechanisms that the global community has established?
Thank you for this difficult question. I think that, of course, the United Nations, it's not a magic pill. It is the United Nations, and it is the system, mechanism, institution focused on governments with everything that goes from there. But also, it's a system where we create and develop human rights. And I think that the human rights idea is our shared idea, something that does not belong to governments, something that does not just belong to the United Nations, but something which is about us and which is about our lives. And I think that the human rights discourse is a discourse. It's created and owned by civil society as well. So if we talk about ILGA specifically, in our constitution, the Constitution of ILGA World, you can open it and see the conventions, the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. So we even adopted these conventions. We put them into our constitutions because that's about our values. And of course, the UN has a lot of weaknesses, especially we see it right now. But also sometimes we can use these to challenge the systems of patriarchy, of ableism, of this heteronormativity, of racism through this system, through the United Nations mechanisms. And I think that, you know, human rights is also a discourse, and we can challenge the system already by our participation there. And sometimes it also can be healing experience. And I know it by myself from my own experience, from my personal experience. But I've also seen it with other people, other activists, that sometimes even going to this system and telling about your pain, telling about situations when you haven't been seen, when your community was discriminated, marginalized, and having the approval in a way, having the recognition of the violation, it already can be healing, especially when your own government, your own country really just exclude you from all the discourses and ideas of human rights. So sometimes the recognition of the violation by the United Nations, it's already something very important on a personal level, on the community level. It's also creating the history, writing histories down, the histories of people from our community who were suffering, sometimes killed, not to make these experiences just disappearing, but writing them, keeping them, putting them into the human rights language through the UN mechanisms, through the courts, through the cases, and so on and so forth. And then also sometimes it can be really just pressure or additional instruments for national authorities when we know that, for example, we need certain legislation. When we know that we need to develop, for example, healthcare system to make them friendly and accommodating for queer women, for lesbian women, for trans women, for trans persons, for non-binary persons, intersex people. And then we know that we need training, for instance, training, education for healthcare professionals, and then we can use the United Nations system for this and to go to, for example, UPR or treaty bodies to explain that this is the problem in our country and we want a recommendation, we want a discussion with the state authorities to make this happening, to make changes happening. And then because it's like a high-level discussion with the participation of civil society, we can also reach out directly to, for instance, health ministers in certain countries and to have this discussion. And this discussion, not just from activists, but the discussion initiated by the UN system. So in this, from this perspective, the UN can be used to balance a little bit power dynamics and imbalance existing between the state and the community and activists. And this UN power can be also shared with activists through these experiences. So that's what I think. But also human rights and the UN, because I think that we need to, well, it's not just like I think we need to, but I see human rights as also something that belongs to us. And this discourse as also our discourse, we are empowered of changing this perspective. Because as I said, it's not just the UN who wants to develop the LGBTI human rights, but it's what we bring to the UN human rights discourse, how we talk and develop decolonial approach, feminist approach, intersectional feminist approach, how we want to deal with the discrimination and violence, but also the systems of oppression and intersecting systems of oppression in terms of human rights. And this is also about solidarity, and solidarity is a very important point, I would say, here. And this is also part of our work. And recently, with all the horrible things that were happening at the UN and in the world, what is really great and healing for me is to see how we build solidarity, how we build solidarity with other movements. For instance, ILGA World works a lot with the Center for Reproductive Rights. We also work with the Sexual Rights Initiative, Euro-Asia Pacific. So all these feminist, for example, organizations who are also targeting the same systems of patriarchal oppressions that we do. And when we are together, of course, we are stronger. And we can support each other. So I think that LGBTI human rights advocacy should also be, and maybe first of all, should be about solidarity, understanding that, for instance, abortion is also a queer struggle, understanding that, you know, queer fight for justice is also about, you know, queer Ukrainians, queer Palestinians, and all the people who suffer. Because after all, it's all about domination and power structures. So that's what is important for me, to be able to use this human rights discourse, but also understanding that it's a shared value. It's something that we share together. It's not just a shared pain, but it's also shared values with other movements and with the intersectional identities and movements within our own movement.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's really great to hear the passion in what you do and what not only you, but all the UN program does and all our colleagues and all the skills and the capacity and the commitment that you all put into everything that you do. And I think that's together with what other organizations do in the end, it would be truly transformative. So here's to that.
Thank you, Daniel. And if anyone wants to know more about the UN, if there are any activists who wants to engage with the UN system or wants to know more how to do it, we are here to support you and just reach out to us to see what we can do together.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Making Rainbow Waves is a podcast by ILGA World. This episode was hosted by Daniele Paletta and edited by Maria Alejandra Gonzalez Silva. You can find every episode on all streaming platforms or on ILGA.org. Thanks for listening.